The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. We've run through Christmas music before on the History of Literature, and we've run through my memories of trips to see my grandparents and all the rest. We talked about Scrooge one year. We talked about James Joyce several years, probably. I don't think we've ever talked about my going to church as a young child. I attended church, a Protestant church, in a little white building in a very small town with stained glass windows on one side of the sanctuary. And every Sunday morning, those windows would be bright with light on sunny days or dim with light when it was overcast. So the colors would either be luminescent, like coral, or dull, like muted clothing in the mist. But color, nevertheless, color and light, those vivid scenes were something to see. They captivated me. Moses bringing down the tablets, Adam and Eve, David and Goliath, Jesus speaking to children, Jesus with a lamb, Jesus talking to his disciples, a holy book, and in the center, Jesus standing in front of a cross, his hands out, palms up, loving and inviting, serene, not flinching at the awful fate that the cross behind him represented. Those were the scenes, and others too, and the sun fired them from behind, radiant on those bright mornings and warm and beautiful on even the cloudiest of days. Except once a year. Once a year, we filed into the rows of pews at night. The Christmas Eve ceremony, the candlelight service, we kids in awe at the power brought about by transformation. Everything was different now. At night, everything was the same, in a way, in an eerie way, the same familiar carpet, the same familiar seats of those wooden pews, the same altars before us. But it was all different. The colors were different. The mood was hushed and quiet. The lights from candles alone held by parishioners was transformative and transfixing. The stained glass that held color every Sunday morning all year without fail was the same, but different too. Those shapes had no color now. They were gray panes with black outlines, no reds or blues or yellows. The candles we held didn't change that. And we had a Christmas tree now in the sanctuary and a nativity scene up front, showing a stable with barn animals and cotton for snow and Mary and Joseph and camels and wise men. And of course, a manger with a baby Jesus inside. It was hushed in there, very, very quiet. And we sang. This evening was the highlight of the year for me. Better than Easter, better than any other hymn, better than Sunday school or the weekly donuts the church ladies made, or the smorgasbord dinner. Better than the smell of coffee and the crumb cakes served after service. Better than the grape juice we drank as communion. Better than dressing up or being in the Christmas pageant or the presents we got each year, another figurine to fill out the nativity scene we had at home, a camel, a shepherd, or that third wise man, the one bringing the myrrh. Better than all that was the hush and the dim and the flicker of candles held by all of us, one to a person. As we opened our hymnals and saw the spots of wax that had dropped on the page from years before. As we all turned to the song, Silent Night. We had reached that moment when Christmas was real. Was like a solstice of sorts, a moment when last year's Christmas had finally faded and this year's Christmas would finally arrive, and soon we would have the family get-togethers with the food and the stories and the presents to open and the movies to watch and the cold Wisconsin air to breathe until we were inside again, warm and safe. This was the moment. This was the hinge. We had sung hymns throughout the service, but then the lights went down and we lit our candles and the room was warm with yellow light and fellowship. And we sang Silent Night together. We knew the story of Jesus. All year long we learned it and marveled at it and worshiped and prayed. We tried to understand his teachings and we tried to live up to them. Some of us tried harder than others. Some of us did better than others. All of us together in that tiny town, in that unassuming little church. Those candles had power. They had magic. And our voices, too, the voices of our neighbors singing. Some people opened their mouths and beauty came rolling out. And others had power in their chest. And some sang with tears in their eyes. And some were, frankly, terrible singers. But that was okay. It was human. And we were standing there together, shoulder to shoulder. And the bad singing blended in with the good as a group of people sang their music in that town, at that time, in that light. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright. Silent night, written for guitar because the church's organ had been damaged by the flooding of a river. Sleep in heavenly peace, young baby. Your life is just beginning. Humans will destroy you. But first they will listen and marvel and learn, and you will die for all of us. But for now, we pay tribute to you, to this moment of your birth, when innocence still reigns supreme. The innocence of you, the innocence of an infant, the innocence of mankind, when we are at our faithful best. It's a story that launched a great religion, a story worthy of 500 books, and yet it's conveyed in barely 500 words. It's almost nothing on the page, the birth of Jesus, but we've added so much more through history, through tradition, through casual gap filling, and through deep, abiding devotion. And now, Stephen Mitchell, our guest today, has written a new book that fleshes out the story even more. It's the story of the first Christmas, today, on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jack Wilson. Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate, and happy holidays to everyone. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men and women. That's my hope this year. Peace and goodwill and health and love. Love. Oh, my goodness. Do we ever need that now? And luck. A little dose of that, too. I've had a bit of both. What am I saying? I meant a bit of luck and a bit of unluck. Unluckiness, I guess I should say. Fortune and misfortune. Misfortune, two words, and misfortune, one word. I didn't mean to say that I've had a little bit of love and a little bit of luck, although I suppose that's true as well. Anyway, we could always use more, couldn't we? So let's do it. And today we have a treat. Stephen Mitchell is here, and he's taken an approach. Well, before I talk about his book, do I need to explain who he is? Maybe so. It's worth spending some time on him because he's given so much to literature. Stephen Mitchell, he's one of the great translators of our age. Translators, adapters. What he's chosen to translate and adapt is pretty fascinating. It's like a list of Jack Wilson's favorite books. Really? Rilke, the Book of Job, Homer, the Gospel According to Jesus, the Tao Te Ching, Gilgamesh, the second book of the Tao, the Bhagavad Gita, The Book of Psalms, Beowulf, what did those have in common? Those books. A lot, actually. Spirituality, dignity, stateliness, wisdom, searching, ancient civilization and religion and culture all bound together in words. And I include Rilke in that when I say ancient. He was an ancient soul. Stephen Mitchell has also written poetry and fiction and children's books of his own, and now he's given us this book, The Story of the Nativity Reimagined. Reimagined, what does that mean? It doesn't mean ahistorical. It means he's taken the text and added what we know, and he's invented or imagined points of view. He's worked his way into it with empathy. He said, here's a character who's barely mentioned, the shepherds, the innkeeper, let's say. Well, let's take the shepherd. What would a shepherd have been doing on that day? Who would he have been at that time? How would he have thought? And what would this experience have meant to him? The story expands in Stephen Mitchell's hands. But by expanding it, we can see the core story more clearly. It's a beautiful book. And he is a wonderful presence, a warm and wise soul whom we are lucky to have. And by we, I mean both the History of Literature podcast, we're lucky to have him as a guest today, but also we strivers, we searchers, we citizens of the world. Stephen Mitchell is a gift. So here's what we're going to do today. We'll take a quick break, then I'm going to read the two stories of the birth of Jesus from the Bible, the one in Matthew and the one in Luke. I'm not including the conception, and I'm not including what came before or what came after, the search of King Herod, all of that. Just focused on what we know about that moment in the stable. Was it a stable? I think you'll be surprised at just how compressed these narratives are. Other parts of the story that we imagine are there, thanks to our many experiences in the culture with the story of Jesus, the many pictures of the nativity scenes we see, those are often added. They're in the Bible as clues, maybe, but they're not actually part of the story of that night when there's no room at the inn and the baby is born. For example, the wise men don't actually show up until later. When they arrive looking for the baby, they're sure must have been born, but they're not actually there that night in the stable, if it's even a stable. We don't know. The Bible doesn't say. Some historians say, well, there's a manger. That's clear. That's explicit. It's mentioned more than once in the Bible. But at that place and time, where they might have been something more like a cave. But the stable is in our minds, isn't it? We like the stable, it fits. So it stays, at least in my mind. It's good enough for me. But I like thinking about why that is and what that does. That it's a stable and not the top of a mountain and not an island in the middle of the sea and not a raft and not a cave. A stable. Just like my church on Christmas Eve, not a bright morning, a darkened sanctuary, with kids excited and parents taking a breath and all of us holding candles and singing Silent Night. The tearing open of packages would be coming soon. For now, it was the reverence and the fellowship, the Silent Night, the Holy Night. All was calm, all was bright. The place matters. The mood matters. When the story matters, the elements of the story matter too. We'll be back after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week. Whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Okay, the first story of the Nativity comes from Matthew. I'll be reading from the Good News translation. There are a lot of good translations. This is the one I grew up with, the birth of Jesus Christ. This was how the birth of Jesus Christ took place. His mother Mary was engaged to Joseph, but before they were married, she found out that she was going to have a baby by the Holy Spirit. Joseph was a man who always did what was right, but he did not want to disgrace Mary publicly, so he made plans to break the engagement privately. While he was thinking about this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, descendant of David, do not be afraid to take Mary to be your wife, for it is by the Holy Spirit that she is conceived. She will have a son, and you will name him Jesus, because he will save people from their sins." Now, all this happened in order to make come true what the Lord had said through the prophet. A virgin will become pregnant and have a son, and he will be called Emmanuel, which means God is with us. So when Joseph woke up, he married Mary as the angel of the Lord had told him to, but he had no sexual relations with her before she gave birth to her son. And Joseph named him Jesus. At that time, Emperor Augustus ordered a census to be taken throughout the Roman Empire. When this first census took place, Quirinius was the governor of Syria. Everyone then went to register himself, each to his own hometown. Joseph went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to the town of Bethlehem in Judea, the birthplace of King David. Joseph went there because he was a descendant of David. He went to register with Mary, who was promised in marriage to him. She was pregnant, and while they were in Bethlehem, the time came for her to have her baby. She gave birth to her first son, wrapped him in cloths, and laid him in a manger. There was no room for them to stay in the inn. That's the story from Matthew, and that is it. I did include a little bit of the beginning, what Joseph saw with the angel of the Lord before he got married. The time came for her to have her baby. She gave birth to her first son, wrapped him in cloths, and laid him in a manger. There was no room for them to stay in the inn. Cloths, manger, no room at the inn. That's barely a story at all. It's a a small handful of details. There's more later in Matthew. There's the escape from Herod. There's the wise men who reach the house where Mary is with the baby Jesus, and they give him their gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But the birth itself, there's no mention of animals or straw or snow outside. We always had snow in our scenes, our nativity scenes in Wisconsin. It's not there in the Bible, of course. There are no camels or oxen or donkeys, not in Matthew. Anyway, let's hear the story as it's told in Luke. The shepherds and the angels. There were some shepherds in that part of the country who were spending the night in the fields, taking care of their flocks. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone over them. They were terribly afraid, but the angel said to them, "Don't be afraid. I am here with good news for you, which will bring great joy to all the people. This very day in David's town, your Savior was born, Christ the Lord. And this is what will prove it to you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." Suddenly, a great army of heaven's angels appeared with the angel, singing praises to God. "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth, peace, goodwill toward men." When the angels went away from them back into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us." So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and saw the baby lying in the manger. When the shepherds saw him, they told them what the angel had said about the child. All who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said. Mary remembered all these things and thought deeply about them. The shepherds went back, singing praises to God for all they had heard and seen. It had been just as the angel had told them. There we go. Cloths and a manger. That's about it. Mary, Joseph, cloth, a manger. Shepherds who find them afterwards. An angel who watches over. Angels who sing and deliver the message from the Lord. I could have told you more about Mary when she gets the news. And Luke goes on to tell the story of Jesus being named and presented in the temple. There's more about the birth of John the Baptist. But the actual story, the one in the nativity scene all over the world, is right there in what I told you. If we just gave the details of what's in that room or that place at the moment of birth, we'd have five or six details. The two parents, cloths, the manger. That's in both accounts. Not much else. And from that, we have grown the entire story. And now we have a new approach to it, to growing that story. The one that says, let's examine this from all different points of view and see what we find there. Surprise, doubt, compassion, excitement, fear, devotion, love. What would be surrounding this event? That's the project of a new book called The First Christmas, A Story of New Beginnings. And the architect of that project is our guest today, Stephen Mitchell, who joins us for more after this. Okay, joining me now is one of the great minds and spirits of our era. He was born in Brooklyn and was educated at Amherst, the Sorbonne, and Yale, and then he was de-educated, so to speak, with intensive Zen training. He's the translator of many classic texts in both Western and Eastern civilization, including several religious and poetic works. He joins us today to discuss his latest book, The First Christmas, A Story of New Beginnings. Stephen Mitchell, welcome to the History of Literature.
Oh, thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Oh, so I can't wait to talk about the book. It takes a brand new approach to a very familiar story just in time for the holidays. But before we get there, I wanted to start with your background.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, your work as a translator. You're well known for your translations, but I kind of consider you as something more than a translator. Do you accept the label of seeker?
Oh, sure. That's a label that I think would have been particularly relevant to me in my 20s and 30s. But after I discovered Zen, I wasn't seeking anymore.
Oh, I see.
I was on a very powerful path to finding and having all the questions that I had about life and the universe resolved through intensive Zen training. So yeah, it would have been very appropriate at a certain point early on in my life.
Right. So were you choosing these works to translate as part of that journey and that quest? Or was it more of a case of publishers were asking you to do it and it just kind of came up one after the other? Or was this part of a search you were on?
Yeah, no publisher actually ever asked me to do anything. I would have finished a project and then sold it to a publisher. But actually, the works chose me. That's the way I think about it. Not that I chose them. And I backed into the whole process of translating. Actually, let me tell you a very short version of a story. When I was 22, my first serious girlfriend broke up with me, and it was a devastating experience. Over the months after that, in trying to find my way through the experience and trying to get a balance, I started to read a lot about suffering and the cause of suffering. And this was way before I discovered Buddhism or Taoism. And the text that meant the most to me at that point, that seemed to me the most profound way to address human suffering in the Western tradition, was the Book of Job. And I became fascinated with the Book of Job, almost obsessed. I would read it over and over in the King James Version, because at the end of the Book of Job, there's a section called the Voice from the Whirlwind, where I felt that the poet who wrote that great, magnificent poem had actually seen something about life and death and the meaning of life, and that if I could somehow understand what that poet saw when he was writing the conclusion of the Book of Job, that I would be able to have some way of dealing with the pain in my heart. So that's why I was so passionately reading the Book of Job over and over and not being able to understand what that vision was. So at a certain point, I decided I would have to learn Hebrew to get closer to the text. So I did, and then I discovered that I would have to learn all sorts of elements of textual scholarship, because the text of Job is a bit of a mess. And anyway, one thing led to another, and I spent 6 years trying to prize out that secret that I felt the poet had seen. And 6 years into the process, one morning I woke up and realized that I was never going to find that answer through reading a text, even with the most magnificent and profound words. So I thought that I'd need to meet that understanding in the flesh rather than read it on a page. And I set out to go to India and try to meet an enlightened master. And before I ever got off the ground from America, I bumped into a Zen master who said, stay with me, I will teach you. And after a year of very intensive training, I had my answer to the Book of Job. So the translation part of that process was my attempt at intimacy with that text, to get as close as I could possibly get to it. It wasn't at the beginning for the sake of creating a powerful new translation of Job. That was a means to my end. But in the end, once I understood, it took me another dozen years to be able to articulate what it was that I understood. But eventually, I was able to publish the translation along with a fairly long introduction, and that was almost 20 years of work into the Book of Job. Later on, I got a lot more efficient translating. It took me 4 months to do the Tao Te Ching. So that's a testimony to the power of the Zen training that I had. Mm. Anyway, the point is that I never set out to do a translation. I just, that was part of my process with the Book of Show.
So in listening to that story, it almost seems like you could have ended there. And I don't want listeners to feel like you then translated that work and that was all you needed to do. You've also translated the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I first encountered you through your translations of Rilke. What was drawing you to those other texts? Was it just knowing that the process of translating would help you understand the works better, or was there something inside those works that you wanted to unlock?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. As far as the poetry of Rilke goes, I had discovered Rilke when I was, I guess, 20 or 21 years old. And that first girlfriend of mine gave me a copy of a translation of his great book, Letters to a Young Poet, in a French version. So I discovered Rilke through that quite amazing collection of letters. And I experienced him as my first spiritual teacher. So when I got back from Paris to America, I learned German so that I could read his poems in the original. And I would walk around with that gorgeous music swirling around in my head in German. And really, it was an experience of poetry like nothing that I had undergone before. Later, after I had a number of years of Zen training under my belt, I discovered a group of late unpublished poems that Rilke had written that I hadn't known before. And I was so fascinated with them that I began to translate them as a way of getting closer again to the great works of art. And one thing led to another, and the poems began to pile up. And eventually, some poets that I knew got very excited about the book and sent it to Random House. And that's how it got published. But again, I was working with this text because I had fallen in love with the poems, just as I had become enchanted and fascinated with the Book of Job. So it's always a question of, it's like falling in love with a woman. You have that immediate, powerful connection, and then you want to become as close as possible. And marriage is the great adventure to become even more connected than what you fell in love with in the first place. So it's like that with working on these great texts. It's a process of discovery and of becoming as intimate as possible with something that you absolutely love.
Right. Well, I think I can guess what the answer is going to be to this, but I'll ask you the question. Your work on the Nativity story in this book that we're talking about today, The First Christmas, what drew you to that work and what were you hoping to gain from this book? It's not a translation, but it seems like your work on it has some of these same elements of allowing you to have a kind of intimacy with the work or a connection to the story that goes beyond what you would get from just reading it and you know, appreciating it that way.
Yeah, that's accurate. There's a Jewish tradition that I respect a lot, and it's called, there's a Hebrew word for it, midrash. A midrash is a kind of creative expansion and exploration of a biblical text or a story. And I've done this before. My previous book was called The Way of Forgiveness, and it's an expansion of the story of Joseph and his brothers from the Book of Genesis. So I love this form. It's a way of inhabiting a biblical text that is often can be written in a very compressed form where lots of room for exploration. So with the Nativity story, it was the same kind of thing. I love the Christmas story. I discovered Christmas as a little 9-year-old Jewish kid being sent to a Christian school for the first time. And I was fascinated with the Nativity scene. So that was an early love of mine. And it wasn't until decades later that I decided to give it my full attention and see if I couldn't create a book that, instead of a one paragraph story, gave flesh and blood and bones to these figures in the tradition. Not only the human figures like Mary and Joseph and the non-human figures like the various angels that appear in the story, but also the animal figures. The ox and the donkey are part of the folkloristic elements of the nativity story that go back many centuries. And all of the elements reflect on each other, and it's a wonderful conflated tale. Most people don't realize how much of a conflation the traditional Christmas story is. In other words, there are two separate accounts in the New Testament, one written by the author called Luke and the other written by the author called Matthew. And both of these stories are incompatible. In other words, there are many contradictions between them. And so the Christmas tradition kind of minimizes the contradictions and puts the two different stories together into one overarching story. So anyway, what I wanted to do with this book was to give readers the kind of pleasure that I myself had from imagining a larger, more vivid, more expansive treatment of this very briefly treated story in the Gospels. And what I did was, I had practiced with the Joseph and his brothers story, but what I did was kind of enter into each of the characters serially and write what it would be like to see the world through their eyes, through the eyes of a donkey, for instance, a visionary donkey, or these very simple shepherds who come to Mary and Joseph in the stable, or wise men. My wise men are not Persian, as in the folkloristic tradition in Christianity, but they're two Jewish scholars who have gone to India to look for an enlightened master and who acquire all sorts of interesting spiritual qualities as a result, and then return to Israel to take in the scene at the manger. So in a number of different ways, I've inserted myself into the characters and tried to see what is the most passionate and insightful expansion of this traditional story. And I had a wonderful time in doing so, and I hope that readers will enjoy it as much as I enjoyed it.
Right. Well, I enjoyed it. I wonder if we could give the listeners an example. And the one I was hoping we could do was the innkeeper, who I think in the gospel, I mean, there's very little about him, and he's come down in the tradition as sort of a crabby, denying person. There's no room for you here. Kind of that's kind of his one line. And then he's off stage, so to speak. But you were able to imagine a different set of motivations and psychology, and kind of give us from historical context and just from, I think, just an act of empathy to imagine what things might have been like for him. And what were you able to put into your version of the innkeeper?
Well, in the original story, there's no innkeeper. There's just an inn. Mm. Everybody knows the line, there was no room for them at the inn. So the gospel writers don't even mention an innkeeper. But of course, if there's an inn, there would have been an innkeeper. So I imagined him not, as you said, a crabby, nasty person who's refusing this young couple with a very pregnant young woman room at his inn. But I imagined the situation in Luke has Mary and Joseph return to Bethlehem because it was Joseph's tribal city. There was supposedly a large Roman census, which historically never took place. So Luke and Matthew both had a couple of, I want to back up here and explain how the story got written. They had a couple of things that they were trying to explain. I should tell your listeners that the gospel account that provides all of the stories that are the doings of Jesus of Nazareth, not necessarily all the sayings, but the doings, comes from Mark, the writer called Mark, and Luke and Matthew are copying basically most of the stories about Jesus, and then they had other sources for the sayings of Jesus. But when Mark wrote his gospel, there was no nativity story. Jesus appears out of nowhere, probably as a disciple of John the Baptist, but there's no infancy story or a story of the Annunciation, etc. in Mark. So when it got to Luke and Matthew 10 or 15 years later, this would have been about 85 or 90 of the Common Era, they had a couple of questions that they needed to resolve through their stories. One is, if Jesus is from Nazareth, how come he was born in Bethlehem? And the other is, what about the rumor that he wasn't a legitimate child? So they had to answer those two questions and others, their stories. In any case, there is no innkeeper in Luke's stories. There's just an inn. And I imagined him as somebody who is overwhelmed by this situation where everybody in Israel has to go to his home. I'm saying his because it's a male thing, his home city. And Bethlehem would have been overrun by people registering this way. And so there would have been hardly any room, if at all, at any of the inns. And in such a situation, looking out for the safety and the welfare of his guests, he wouldn't have been able to admit anybody else into the rooms. And then at the last moment in my story, he realizes that there's a dilapidated old barn out and back that this young couple can use for a few days. So it's only his carefulness, his concern for his guests that is tempting him to turn the young couple away in the first place. And then the interesting thing that happens once I began to imagine that scene is that there was a point at which there's a current of sympathy that starts running between the innkeeper and Joseph. The innkeeper sees a kind of sincerity and integrity on the part of the young man who is not trying to persuade him to let them in, but is just putting out his situation with his very pregnant young wife by his side and letting the innkeeper find the solution himself. So the current of sympathy has established itself between the innkeeper and Joseph, and that's what leads to his brainstorm about the dilapidated stable. So we can see that he's a good man who, through this understanding that something is going on between him and Joseph, opens himself up to a solution, a compassionate solution to the problem. And I thought that was pretty amazing to discover once I was able to enter the character.
Right. I just was so floored by it, and it put me in the right frame of mind to read the rest of your project. So basically, it was, there isn't even an innkeeper, but we know there's an inn, and we know there's no room for them at the inn. But what you've inserted into the story then is, well, this is probably an innkeeper who's been run off his feet, so to speak, for the last couple of weeks. As these people come in, you suggest that the people who are coming to the inn and taking up rooms are probably some of the wealthier people who are demanding that he accommodate them in one way or another, or make him feel like he owes them something. They ask for discounts and that kind of thing. And then when this couple comes, we do know that they were given a spot. Whether there was no room for them at the inn, they found this solution. And you put that into the mind of the innkeeper of, I think I can do something for you. And it's an act of generosity and an act of communion and recognizing oneself in others. And it just opens a whole new door to what is a very, in the text, a very small part of the nativity story, but has kind of, it just got me to rethink that aspect of it in a way that I found completely refreshing.
Yeah, isn't it wonderful? I love the possibilities that the story opens up. The compression of the storyteller is so powerful. You assume that there are a lot of things in the original story that aren't actually there, like an innkeeper. But there are all sorts of things implicit in the story that, just as a matter of attention, kind of bloom into reality when you give it time and energy. Another example is the animals, you know, that are not in the gospel stories. They're part of the folklore tradition that grew up around this story in the centuries after the stories were first written. But to enter the consciousness of an articulate ox, who was one of the great delights for me of the experience. The ox has a kind of Whitman-esque breadth about his consciousness and a rather condescending attitude of self-satisfaction about being a kosher animal versus a non-kosher animal like a donkey. So there are a lot of really amusing things for me that I discovered in the process of sinking into the character. And I hope that readers will be as delighted as I have been.
Yeah. And then the interludes that you provide are instructive. So just so listeners understand, there's the interspersed with the storytelling are interludes that are reflective and provide some historical context and talk about the text and what we know of the text, and then provide some, I guess, how would you describe it, musings or words of wisdom, words to reflect upon?
That's accurate. I originally didn't have these interludes in the text, and my editor, after reading a previous version, said, I think it would be wonderful to have more of your authorial voice.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I invented the interludes that follow each of the chapters. Maybe the thing that I felt was the most important thing I discovered when I was entering these characters was about the character of Mary. You know, we tend to imagine the nativity story, as we imagine a lot of the gospel stories, through our experience of paintings. And all the nativity scenes in the famous works of art, European works of art, you'll see, or the Annunciation scenes as well, when the angel Gabriel announces what's going to happen to Mary. In all of these scenes, painters depict Mary as a kind of royal figure in the most gorgeous silks and satins, and with an infant God on her lap and angels around, and everybody's celebrating the occasion. But that is a much later Christian interpretation. The story itself talks about two young Jewish people in the year 3 or 4 before the Common Era, when Christian concepts about the Messiah, such as the Messiah has to die to save humanity from sin, or the Messiah is actually one of the three people in the Trinity. All of those concepts would have seemed not only blasphemous, but actually insane to Jewish characters living in the year 4 BCE, for example. So I had to step in 40 or 50 years before Christian concepts began to be elaborated by St. Paul and other early Christian writers, and reimagine those two characters not knowing anything about concepts about Jesus or the Messiah. So for them, for Mary and for Joseph, as Jewish characters, the Messiah would have been somebody born who would become the king of the country and would usher in 1,000 years of peace. That's it. Peace would have been the proof that somebody was actually the Messiah. No more war, no more problems, no more hatred, bitterness, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what Mary would have and Joseph would have understood from any kind of angelic announcement. Now, the fascinating thing about Mary's story is that far from being the cherished young woman who's the mother of God and the queen of heaven, et cetera, et cetera. In the actual story, when she became pregnant, she would have been despised and hated by everybody in the village, including her parents, because obviously she would have been pregnant unmarried, and nobody else would have received the angelic announcement of the virginal conception from the mouth of the archangel Gabriel. So in fact, Mary, after her great agreement to go through this experience of virginal conception, she would have been the only one who understood what had been announced. Everybody else in the village would have seen her as a whore, somebody who got pregnant without being married, including her beloved fiancé, Joseph. And Joseph would have had to go through the most radical, painful experience of understanding and then forgiveness of Mary for her crime of getting pregnant. So all of these later Christian perspectives, when you look beyond that, you're looking into a story of great dramatic power, a story of surrender on the part of Mary and forgiveness on the part of Joseph, because Mary would have had to surrender everything that she held dear, including the man that she was in love with and was about to marry, because by saying yes to the angel, by saying yes to becoming pregnant with the Messiah, she would have had to renounce her forthcoming marriage, because everything would have told her that Joseph would have rejected her and thought of her as an unclean woman who had gotten pregnant outside of marriage. So an experience, her yes would have been an experience of enormous courage and surrender, of giving up everything that she cherished, including her parents, her fiance, her town, her own hometown, and being despised by everybody that she knew. What an amazing yes that was, if you understand it correctly. And Joseph's yes, going through all his suffering, his jealousy, his disappointment in Mary's chastity, et cetera, et cetera. And finally understanding that his love for her didn't depend on anything that she could possibly do. It was just there for her unconditionally. And those decisions, those acceptances, and the end of the spiritual process for both of them puts them in a light that is very hard to see from the original story, actually, because there are so many later religious concepts plastered onto that simple, powerful story.
Right.
Anyway, it was so exciting for me to discover that, and I hope that readers will be excited in the same way to discover it through the book.
Mm. So I can understand why the nativity story appealed to you as a young Jewish child in a Christian school. And I'm a little more curious. I wonder if you have some thoughts on the writer Anne Lamott, who has said that the nativity is her favorite story of all, which is a kind of a curious thing to say, that even in the New Testament, there are such, even if we just stick to the New Testament, there are such vivid stories like the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus in the temple and the crucifixion and everything. What do you think is special about the narrative of the nativity?
You know, it's a great question. I think that the nativity story, even for those of us who aren't Christians, is associated with the whole experience of generosity around the holiday of Christmas. Gift giving and good food and getting together with people that you love and trees and Christmas music, et cetera. So all of that holiday cheer rubs off on the original story, even though it's not in the original story.
Yeah.
And also, you know, you could say that the nativity story has nothing to do with the historical figure of Jesus of Nazareth. And in a real sense, that's true.
Right.
The stories were invented decades after he died to answer pressing questions that the Christian community had about him and about his status, etc. On the other hand, you could say that the nativity story, even though it has nothing to do with the historical Jesus, it represents him in a really authentic way, especially through the element in Luke's story where the angels from heaven sing and chant peace on earth, goodwill toward men. That, you could say, is the essence of Jesus's teaching too. And so it's a story that really, in that sense, represents him very well and extremely economically too. And that one phrase out of the angel's mouth, you're hearing so much of what Jesus was about in the first place. So I think Anne Lamott is voicing an opinion that a lot of Christians and non-Christians have too, about the beauty of that story and how, even though it was invented later, Jesus wouldn't have recognized any of the elements in either Luke's or Matthew's stories. But I think he would have approved, especially because of that, the angel's song in Luke's story.
Yeah, it seems like it's about hope and promise.
Yeah, the promise of peace, you know, it's a story that the whole concept of the Messiah is a very peculiar one, actually. It's a story that gives hope to many people, millions of people throughout history. And it's a hope that's never going to happen, of course, because the whole idea of world peace and a situation without human problems is an idealization. It's not going to happen, and lions are never going to start eating straw like oxes. It's not physically possible. But what the story is saying is really an externalization of an inner truth. At the beginning of the book, I have an epigraph that is a story that I heard from a rabbi friend of mine. It says, at the Passover Seder, a Hasidic rabbi told his chief disciple to go outside and see if the Messiah had come. But Rabbi, the disciple said, pointing to his heart, if the Messiah has come, wouldn't you know it in here? Ah, said the rabbi, pointing to his own heart, in here, the Messiah has already come. So I love that story.
Yeah.
It's deep in many ways, but what it points out explicitly is that an inner reality, somebody whose heart has come to peace, peace on earth, peace in this one person on earth, goodwill radiating out from that realization, that for somebody who's had that inner experience, the outer experience isn't necessary. It's irrelevant. That person doesn't need there to be 1,000 years of external peace for him or her to experience the exquisite, world-shattering, world-enhancing realization of peace that doesn't need an external support to it. So it's a beautiful story that really isn't about an idealization or a fantasy, but is a way of talking about what happens to a person who understands.
The book is called The First Christmas, A Story of New Beginnings. Stephen Mitchell, thank you so much for joining me on The History of Literature.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. My thanks to Stephen Mitchell for joining me. I will be back on Thursday, if all goes well, with a little more about Stephen Mitchell, or a little more Stephen Mitchell, in spirit anyway. We're going to take a look at one of Rilke's letters about Christmas, and Stephen Mitchell was our translator. I hope you are all holding up in this time of crisis and sickness, and hopefully some health and good cheer, too. Hang in there, everyone. You are not alone. Whoever you are not alone, because you are with us. Those of us who are with you and rooting for you and who wish you the very best. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.